This evening, we'll be dealing with the issue of the existence of God. We'll actually be handling this in two parts. We'll be giving the two major cosmological arguments for the existence of God. Here, we want to establish that the God of the theistic worldview exists. What we've done up to this point is establish a criterion for truth, and we've been able to use that criteria for truth, that test for truth, to eliminate all the worldviews except for theism. And here we want to give the positive argument for the existence of God, and we'll be doing that again in two parts. First, our objectives. Tonight, I want to explain how the vertical cosmological argument demonstrates that the Christian God exists. It's important to understand that we're not just arguing for theism. That's important, and there are many arguments that can do that in terms of establishing it, but we're particularly interested in establishing the existence of the Christian God, and two, to answer various objections to the arguments for the Christian God. Now, I'd like to do a brief history slash somewhat of a metaphysical lesson before we jump right into our vertical cosmological argument. It is often put forth that these two individuals, as well as many others, have basically dealt a death blow to any argument, particularly the traditional arguments that I just outlined for you with regards to the existence of God. So let me give you a brief introduction to both of these two individuals and describe them in terms of what they have done in terms of a critique or dealing what some have called a death blow to the arguments for the existence of God. First of all, René Descartes is a French mathematician. He started out doing philosophy with the hope that he could establish as much certitude he had in mathematics, that he could establish the same level and type of certitude that would exist in the area of religion, particularly with regards to the existence of God and a knowable external world. And he started out in his meditations arguing for the existence of God, and as he started out in his argumentation for the existence, he started first trying to establish the existence of a knowable external world. He soon abandoned that and went on in hopes of arguing for the existence of God, and then arguing for the existence of God, he hoped he could then establish the existence of an external knowable world. Most modern philosophers following him looked back upon René Descartes as being a failure at what he did. He was a rationalist in the sense that he believed that he could establish everything, or at least believed that everything he would establish would be known with absolute certitude, the same level he had in mathematics in regards to God and other philosophical issues as well. Well, Immanuel Kant follows him, and there's about 150 years between their works. Immanuel Kant follows him. And Immanuel Kant levels what many even today believe is a death blow to any of the traditional arguments for the existence of God. And he argued primarily that all the arguments, traditional arguments put forth for the existence of God are reducible to the ontological argument. And of course, as we just showed, he demonstrated that the ontological argument is invalid. And he says if all the other arguments are reducible to the ontological argument, then all the other arguments are as invalid as the ontological argument is invalid. But I'd like to point out what neither of these individuals knew of. And in fact, I've read Neo-Thomists. Who have written stating that it's the fact that none of these men and none of and very little of modern philosophy following them in terms of the critiques that they leveled for the traditional arguments for the existence of God really knew much of Aquinas. And I think that's demonstrable. And if you look at who, for example, Immanuel Kant studied under, he studied his metaphysics under Christian Wolff, who studied his metaphysics under Leibniz, who ultimately looked at René Descartes as failing but trying to improve upon him. What is clearly evident in reading these individuals is that none of them had recourse to understanding the arguments as they existed in the medieval time period, such as Thomas Aquinas's argument for the existence of God. In fact, Coppelson, a neo-Thomist writing on Immanuel Kant in his book on Aquinas, flat out says that Immanuel Kant knew nothing of Thomas Aquinas. That being the case, I'd like to make the suggestion that the type of argument that Thomas Aquinas gave is substantially different than the arguments that René Descartes gave and the types of arguments that Immanuel Kant evaluated. Descartes started with the assertion, "I think, therefore I am." This assertion is not the same starting point as Thomas Aquinas's starting point, or as I'll phrase it here, as Norman Geisler states in his vertical cosmological argument that something exists. I'd like to submit to you that these are two very, very different starting points. If modern philosophy is going to critique things in terms of a Kantian understanding of metaphysics and understand the arguments through the guise of Immanuel Kant and others like him, they're missing the starting point of the medieval argument for the existence of God. And one of the ways I often use to demonstrate this, and we'll talk more about this issue when we do our unit on metaphysics, the first one, it deals with the notion of thought. It deals with the establishment of a thinking mind. The second one deals with the establishment or with the undeniable existence of something, as we've stated many times before, that something exists. Philosophy, Descartes thought, philosophy had to establish or had to be used to establish the existence of an external knowable world. And therefore, he began with his thinking self and established his thinking, his thought. The second one dealt with the fact that philosophy is not able to establish that which is already evident to us, that which is already known to us. All we can do is state it in terms that are philosophically undeniable. That is, this is the difference between beginning with thought is versus being is. And this is a radical difference, a huge difference, in terms of the arguments for the existence of God and the critique that is leveled at them. Here's a quote from Mortimer Adler, who's a popular Thomist. He says, "Not until Descartes in the 17th century did any philosopher engage in an experiment of doubt that required him to argue for the existence of the external physical world. Doubting the evidence presented by his senses, Descartes too took refuge in what appeared to him an undeniable truth. His doubting involved his thinking, and if he was thinking, he could not avoid the conclusion that a thinking being existed. However, his cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, did not establish the existence of Descartes, the human individual body and mind, but only the existence of his intellect, the agency of his doubting and thinking. From that conclusion, he developed a highly questionable argument for the existence of God." This is what most people are critiquing in terms of an argument for the existence of God, Descartes' version of it, or some version that is not significantly different than Descartes. And I would submit to you that the critiques of Descartes' argument are not the same, or at least I would put it this way, that the critique that is leveled against Descartes' argument is not disruptive of the type of argument that I'm giving in terms of the vertical cosmological argument that is based on existential undeniability. The two starting points are radically different. And as the Neo-Thomists are often said to have said, that if you begin in the mind, you will never get out of the mind. If you start with a psychological assertion, you will never get out of that and start doing philosophy. But if you start with undeniable first principles that are existentially undeniable, then that's something we can build upon in terms of doing philosophy. And that's what the medievals did. That is not what modern philosophy, unfortunately, is doing today. Now, I'd also like to establish, in following up with some things that we said about Immanuel Kant, is that Kant doesn't have an approach that is all that much different. Now, he has a much more sophisticated metaphysical understanding, but nonetheless, he puts forward the notion that the mind itself does not know the external world, and we cannot bridge this gulf or this gap that exists. We have the objects in our mind that we know that gives form and shape, but the thing in itself or the object in reality is something that we do not know and cannot know. Now, he didn't completely outright deny the existence of the thing in itself or the existence of an external knowable world, but he did say that the mind gave creation or gave existence to us. In terms of that which is impressed upon it from the thing in itself. But he did not say, and he denied, that we know the thing in itself. Hence, this gulf or this gap exists in terms of the external knowable world. Mortimer Adler says this in regards to this understanding: Does the conceived object really exist? Is a question that should never be asked about a validly perceived or remembered object. Yet in modern philosophy, and only in modern philosophy, it has been asked persistently in antiquity and in the Middle Ages. No philosopher ever asked for a proof, or anything like a proof, for the reality of the external world, for the reality of the past, or the reality of other minds. And the reason for that is because in the medieval period, they took the position that philosophy itself as a subject, it has its limitations. And if reality itself can't convince you that it's real, no philosophical argumentation about reality is going to fare any better. To put it in more concrete terms, if the brick wall can't convince you that it's real, a philosophical argument about the brick wall isn't going to do any better. That being the case, I'd like to suggest that the starting points, are quite different. And not only that, the metaphysical understanding of what goes on in modern philosophy really rests on the Kantian assumption of this gulf that exists. Even those who would purport realism are often divided over the issue. For example, a critical realist will start with the assumption of Immanuel Kant and simply argue and believe that he is able to establish that we do know the thing in itself or bridge the gulf that exists. If the critical realist is thought successful, then he becomes a critical realist. If he's thought unsuccessful, then he becomes an idealist because he can't get to the thing in itself. And hence, all we have is our mind's creation of the impressions that are made via our senses of the way the world is, with no exact or no way to know that it's corresponding exactly to the way the thing is in itself. That being the case, the result of this Kantian assumption is either critical realism or idealism. But it's moderate realism, and we'll talk much more about that in our unit on metaphysics, but it's moderate realism that simply ignores the ex assumption, the Kantian assumption of a gulf existing, and say and notes that the world is just evident to us, and all we can do is give a philosophical description of it and assert things that are undeniable about it and move on and to do our philosophy. The argument I'm going to give at length tonight is the vertical cosmological argument. I'll first give the argument in brief here, and then we'll discuss each premise individually, and then we'll answer various objections to the argument itself. The argument starts with something undeniably exists. Again, based on our previous discussion, it is not starting with thought or thought is, but it's starting with being or being is. Nothing cannot cause something. Something eternally and necessarily exists. I am not eternal and necessary. Whatever is not eternal and necessary needs a cause. Therefore, there is an eternal and necessary cause of my existence. But I am a personal, moral, and intelligent being. But only a personal, moral, and intelligent being can create a personal, moral, and intelligent being. Therefore, a personal, moral, intelligent, eternal, and necessary being exists. From this argument, the notion that God is eternal and necessary is established within the first three premises. It then takes the notion of making observations about oneself in a admittedly definitional sense of ontology of being, of looking at ourself, and extrapolating certain things back to that which is eternal and necessary, since they're true about me, and that which is eternal and necessary is my cause of my existence, then I can extrapolate in those things about me, particularly personality, morality, and intelligence, back upon God, and they must exist in God, since He caused them to exist in me. They must exist in Him in an infinite and eternal sense. So that's the way we argue. And of course, at the end of this, as well as the end of the horizontal argument we'll do, we want to connect this, the existence of this God, with the God of Christianity or the Christian scriptures. And hence, if God is the same of both our argument and the Christian scriptures, and our argument shows that He exists, then we have a basis for the existence of God that is actually outside the Bible, and at the same time can connect the existence of God with the God of Scripture. So let's start with the first premise. Something undeniably exists. And the way we can demonstrate this is simply by making the assertion that I exist in an existential sense. This cannot be denied, since it is self-defeating to do so. If I make the assertion I do not exist, I affirm my very existence in the assertion that I do not exist. I would have to exist to deny my own existence. If I exist, then it naturally follows that something exists instead of nothing or nothingness. Since I cannot deny my own existence without asserting my own existence, it is self-defeating to put forward the notion that I do not exist. That being the case, something must exist, namely, I exist, and it's not nothing or nothingness that exists. Now, this notion of nothing or nothingness, and by that I mean the absence of being itself. The notion of nothing or nothingness can cause many people to stumble, because once I try to think of nothing, I form a concept of in my mind that itself takes on the notion of nothingness. But by nothingness, I mean even not even the concept of nothing. So the best way to assert the notion of nothingness is simply the absence of being, the exact absence of anything that exists, including the cognitive concept I have of nothingness. Second premise asserts that nothing cannot cause something. Nothing comes from nothing. And here again, I must put forward the notion that I'm not talking about the concept of nothing that we would formulate in our mind, but simply the absence of being. If nothing exists, if there's non-being, it cannot produce being. A cause has to exist to cause something to exist. I cannot have caused my own existence. There must be an existing cause. There's no such thing as a non-existing cause. Again, if something exists, and I've made that assertion and backed it up, it follows from that, the second assertion, that nothing cannot cause something, which is another first principle. Well, from these two principles, first principles, in my premise for my argument, an amazing third conclusion results. That is, something eternally and necessarily exists. Let me put it more succinctly. Being exists, we've established that. Non-being cannot produce being, we've established that. Therefore, something, being, exists that must be necessary and eternal. Since contingent beings exist. Contingent beings can go out of existence, and there's no necessity to their existence. There's nothing that makes them exist necessarily. They don't exist necessarily. Then something must have always existed. A contingent being was not at one time but came to be. A necessary being must be and cannot not be by definition. But a contingent being cannot produce a necessary being. So therefore, it takes the necessary being to produce the contingent being. Sometimes I put it this way to my students: if I exist and then cease to exist, what's left? What if everything ceases to exist at the snap of my fingers? If I can snap my fingers and everything that exists, everything we know exists, what's left? Is anything left? If we answer no, nothing is left, if I snap my fingers and everything that exists ceases to exist, including myself and the snapping of my fingers, if we assert that nothing is left, then you have no explanation for why anything previously existed. But if you say, no, something has to be left that exists, then I assert that that which is left must be eternal and necessary in terms of its existence. And that is the cause of everything that exists that's not eternal and necessary, that needs to exist, that's contingent being. So it's quite remarkable that in three premises, we've argued successfully that something eternal and necessary exists. The fourth premise states that I am not eternal and necessary. This seems to be straightforward. My existence is contingent. First off, I have not always existed, I have not always been, and I could easily cease to exist. That being the case, my existence is contingent, and I cannot make the assertion that I am eternal and necessary in terms of my existence. Now, I could, if I were a pantheist, for example, I could make the assertion that I'm eternal and necessary, but not everything sayable is defendable. I can't defend the notion that I am eternal and necessary. But of course, no one can make the assertion and back up the assertion that I am eternal and necessary with regards to my existence, because it can easily be demonstrated that my existence in eternality is not necessary. First of all, I have not always been, and second of all, I could cease to be. That being the case, you can certainly say it, but you can't back it up. Now, some might make the assertion that, at least in a pantheistic understanding, that they're a part of that which is eternal and necessary. But again, that which is eternal and necessary cannot have parts with regards to its existence. This ultimately denies even the notion of asserting something individual about myself. If you could go back and think back to our review of pantheism, the notion of God is all, God is, but I am not, is something that is self-defeating ultimately. The notion that I am eternal and necessary has at least an indirect element that is self-defeating about it, since I could not be and haven't always been. While you can certainly say these things, you can't demonstrate their truth with regards to it, and I would follow under the same criticism that we've made of pantheism if I try to make that assertion here. So it seems to be evident that I am not eternal and necessary. Whatever is not eternal and necessary needs a cause. Since this notion of me not being eternal and necessary is also directly related to this notion of act and potency, or actualization and potentiality, which is just a metaphysical way of describing change. The fact that I change Is also a notion of the fact that I'm not eternal and necessary. In other words, I have actuality in the sense that I exist, but I also have potentiality in the fact that I can change, I can come to be, I can actualize certain potentialities about myself in terms of learning or other ways in which I can undergo change. But whatever can cease to be, as we've pointed out, or has not always been, needs a cause. I'm not eternal and necessary, and it follows from that that whatever is not eternal and necessary needs a cause. Therefore, there is an eternal and necessary cause of my existence. Again, since I'm a contingent being, I need something that is a necessary being to account for my existence. The reason I need that is because we cannot have an infinite regress of eternal of contingent beings that goes back into the past forever. You can't have that because you would have to have something in the series of contingent beings that is not only causing the contingent another contingent being to exist, but is also causing itself to exist. The very fact that you cannot have an infinite regress because you cannot have something that is both causing something else and causing itself, because causa sui or self-existence is impossible. So therefore, you must account for the series of contingent beings existing that is actually outside of the series of contingent beings, that which is not contingent, but that which is eternal and necessary. In other words, you must have a necessary being to account for all the contingent beings that exist. Hence, there has to be something that is eternal and necessary that is the cause of my existence. But I note this about myself. I am a personal, moral, and intelligent being. These are things that are simply evident about myself and evident to me about myself. For example, I use my personality in the notion of choosing. To assert my personality or even to deny my personality. For example, if I say I'm not a personal being, I chose to make the assertion that I'm a personal being, but only personal beings can choose to do that. So in the very act of making the assertion that I'm not a personal being, I reveal the fact that I am a personal being because I chose to do that rather than asserting that I am a personal being. Because again, only personal beings can make choices. Rocks are not personal beings because they don't make any choices. But if I can make the assertion that I'm a personal being, or that the assertion that I'm not a personal being, it requires that I choose and exert my own personality in terms of making that choice to make the assertion. But of course, if I make the assertion that I'm not a personal being, it's ultimately self-defeating, because it shows that I've made the choice to make that assertion. Likewise, someone could make the assertion with regards to morality that they're not a moral person. And by morality, I simply mean good. Someone can make the assertion that they're not a good person. But of course, in making the assertion that they're not a good person, they actually rely upon the notion of goodness, that it's good to make assertions, that it is something inherently good about assertions being made versus not being made. So the notion of goodness relies, or the assertion of even denying my goodness relies on the goodness of the assertion itself. So I could certainly make the assertion that I'm not a moral person or that I'm not a good person, but of course I rely on the notion that it is good, or rely on the notion of goodness to make such an assertion. Now, of course, my favorite is the last one. I can make the assertion that I am not an intelligent being, but of course, I exert my intelligence in making that actual assertion. I can certainly say I'm not an intelligent being, but I express it in an intelligent statement, and hence it's directly self-defeating. So these things are clearly evident about myself, that I am a personal being, I am a moral being, and I am an intelligent being. And if I try to assert the opposite of these, I actually rest on or reveal the notion that they exist about myself, either directly or indirectly with regards to my assertions. Eight says, but only a personal, moral, and intelligent being can create a personal, moral, and intelligent being. Now here, we have to make a very important distinction in regards to causation. There are two basic types of causation that exist. One is referred to as extrinsic causation, and the other is referred to as intrinsic causation. Let me give you an example of extrinsic causation. An extrinsic causation is when only the effect, not the cause, has the characteristic. For example, if I boil water and I take an egg and I place the egg in the boiling water, eventually the boiling water will cause the egg to become hard. In other words, the egg takes on the characteristic or the property of hardness. But it's interesting to note that the water does not contain the property of hardness. That water is a liquid even in its boiling state. The water has the characteristic or the property of a liquid, but it's able to cause hardness to occur in the egg. Hence, this is the notion of what we mean by extrinsic causality. The other type of causality is intrinsic causality. Now, in intrinsic causality, both the effect and the cause has the characteristic. For example, if I take boiling water and I drop a ice cube into the boiling water, eventually and very quickly the ice cube will take on the property or the characteristic of the boiling water. It will become liquid and eventually the temperature will rise. In this case, the boiling water causes intrinsically ice to take on its quality or characteristic that it possesses intrinsically. This type of causation that we're asserting here in premise 8 is the notion of intrinsic causality, that because I possess these things intrinsically, only that which also possesses them intrinsically can give them to me. In other words, it can't be something that is extrinsically possessed by God or by the causal agent. It has to be something that is possessed intrinsically with regards to the causal agent. That's because these things are ultimately assertions about myself that are immaterial. They're not material. If I put forth the assertion that I have a body, therefore God has a body, that wouldn't follow because something that is put forth with regards to the assertion of matter can't be made to be or understood in an infinite sense. Infinite matter is just a contradiction. Matter is always finite and completely understood in a finite sense. So if the causal agent is able to cause me to have a body, it must be an extrinsic causation. However, these things, because they're immaterial, are clearly intrinsic causations. Then, therefore, I can attribute these intrinsic things about me back to God. I possess them in a finite sense or in a contingent sense because God or because something that is eternal and necessary exists. They must be attributed to that which is eternal and necessary in an infinite sense or in an eternal sense. So therefore, that's what's being done here in premise 8. A being cannot intrinsically give or produce what it does not intrinsically have. So if these are intrinsic or immaterial and I possess them, then I must understand them in that which is eternal and necessary in an intrinsic or an immaterial sense with regards to causation. What follows from this that therefore a personal, moral, intelligent, eternal, and necessary being exists. Now, of course, I've established his eternality and his necessary based on premises 1 through 3, and I've established the notion that he's personal, moral, and intelligent on premises 5 through 8 of my argument. Well, it follows, I think, from this that whatever notion we would put forth with regards to what we want to understand about God, it would at least minimally contain these things, that he's moral, personal, intelligent, eternal, and necessary. Now, you can call him whatever you want or name him whatever you want, but nonetheless, I think that most would put forward the notion that this is indeed what we mean by the term God. Now, that being the case, I want to put forward the notion, or at least put forward an additional argument or attached to this of how we can get to the God of Christianity. How do we know that this God is the God of the Bible? Well, let's first point out the things that I've concluded from the previous argument. First of all, God is personal since he created personal beings. God is powerful since he created the whole universe. God is intelligent since he created intelligent beings. God is moral or good since he created good creatures. God is necessary being since he cannot not exist or has no being or is eternal since he has no end. He's also unchanging since he cannot come to be. If you remember, that which is contingent changes in terms of its actuality and potentiality, but God must be pure act, hence he must be unchanging to account for anything that is contingent in its being. God is infinite since he cannot not be and is therefore omnipresent, or that means he is present everywhere. He's not bound by that which is material, or that which is material cannot be attributed to him in an intrinsic sense. Therefore, he must be infinite. So our argument establishes at least these things about God. Obviously, if there's personal beings exist, that's something that's immaterial that can be attributed back to him. He must be powerful in the sense that he's all-powerful since he is responsible for all that which is contingent in its existence existing, which applies to the entire universe, material universe. He's intelligent since he created intelligent creatures. That can be attributed back to him because it's immaterial as well. He's moral since he created good creatures, which is attributable back to him in an immaterial sense. He must be necessary since you cannot have an infinite regress of contingent beings. He's the necessary being, which needs to be accounted for the existence of all contingent beings. He's unchanging since he can't be composed of act and potency. He must be pure act to account for all that is existing, which is changing. And he must be infinite since he cannot not be in terms of his existence. And if he cannot not be, then his existence must be everywhere. And that's simply what we mean by omnipresent. Well, when we turn the pages of the scriptures, we find that this very God, in terms of possessing these attributes in a metaphysical sense, does exist. In fact, one of the most metaphysical things that can be said about God is that he is Yah or Yahweh. Exodus 3:14 makes this plain, that when God is before Moses in terms of the burning bush, Moses asks what his name is or what he should call him. He says, "I am who I am." That in a very deep Hebrew sense, God is existence itself. That being the case, when we turn to the pages of Scripture, we find indeed that Yahweh is spoken of or taught what is taught in terms of what is true about God in this sense, that he is personal, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, eternal, unchanging, and infinite. Well, it just so happens that the argument that I just gave concluded these very same things about God. It follows from that that there could be only one being, one ultimate, that possesses these very metaphysical attributes. There can be only one being that is personal, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, eternal, unchanging, and infinite. Why can there only be one being that possesses all of these? Because if there were two beings that possessed all of these, you'd have to be able to tell them apart. But the only way you could tell them apart is to note that one lacks one of these things and the other one has it. But if one lacks one of these things, then he's not the ultimate being. That being the case, there would be a difference between them, and one of them wouldn't be ultimate, so you wouldn't have two ultimate beings, you'd only have one ultimate being. So if these can be asserted by both the God who is affirmed in the Old and New Testament and the God of my argument, they must be the identical being. Now, there's a further confirmation we'll make when we do evidential apologetics in a historical sense, is we'll put forward the notion That God, via miracles, is able to use miracles as a sign to indicate his presence and his message. And these are really the only two ways that we have to connect our philosophical argumentation with the God of Christianity. One is by arguing in terms of their metaphysical attributes are identical, and the other is by affirming in a historical sense that God has indeed done miracles and confirmed through his prophets and scripture, and particularly the grandest miracle being the resurrection, that he has affirmed himself through the Judeo-Christian religious tradition. And of course it would follow from that that God would not affirm himself and that which is opposed to the Judeo-Christian religion, and hence it would follow that only the Judeo-Christian religion is true and that which is opposed to it is false. And since the other religions are directly opposed to it, other monotheistic faiths such as Islam are opposed to it, in a historical sense, God has only revealed himself in the Judeo-Christian religion. So now we want to answer some objections to our argument for the existence of God. The first objection to my argument that I just gave is, if everything needs a cause, then so does God, ad infinitum. So ultimately, this puts forward the notion that everything needs a cause and believes that I've stated an argument that affirms this principle that everything needs a cause, and then so does my God need a cause. But I would put forward the notion that everything does not need a cause. In fact, this is the argument that's put forward from sufficient reason, that everything needs a cause. But I did not use the principle of sufficient reason in my argumentation. This was a mistake that has been made by many with regards to the arguments for the existence of God, including Immanuel Kant raised this objection to the arguments for the existence of God. But if we go back to the medieval sense of this notion of causation, my reply is that everything does not need a cause. I did not use a principle that put forward the notion that everything needs a cause. I put forward a principle that only finite, limited, and or temporal things need a cause. That's the only principle I used, which is a principle of causation, not the principle of sufficient reason. So that's the only principle that's assumed or that is used in my argument for the existence of God, and it seems to be a first principle, that if something is limited, finite, and changing, it needs a cause. God doesn't need a cause because he's uncaused. You can have something that's uncaused. Remember, there's only three types of causation we can make appeal to. We can make an appeal to a self-caused, caused by another, or uncaused. Self-causation is causa sui, which is impossible. Caused is with respect to only that which is finite and changing and does need a cause, but there's also the category of uncaused. And God is uncaused since he's the cause of everything that needs a cause. God doesn't need a cause, therefore. Some would say that my argument for the existence of God commits the fallacy of composition. It says that the whole does not necessarily have the characteristic of its parts. This puts forward the notion that just because the universe is made up of contingent beings, I don't therefore need to assume that the cause of that is something that is not contingent. They would put forth the notion or the argument that the whole does not necessarily have the characteristics of its parts. For example, they would say that you can have two triangles. You can put the two triangles together, and it does not give you a triangle. And even though the object is composed of two triangles, the object that is produced by putting the two together does not give you a triangle, and in fact gives you a square. So it is likewise argument that what I've committed is the fallacy of composition in my argumentation. Just because we put all the contingent beings together, or all the effects together, doesn't therefore mean that the entirety is an effect or is contingent in and of itself. And that being the case, they would put forward the notion that maybe putting them all together gives us something that is necessary, and therefore we don't need something outside of putting all the contingency together that calls for something outside of itself, such as being eternal and necessary, being a cause of it. But I think that what's missing in this is that oftentimes what you need to do is look at that which is intrinsic about the things that you are putting together. For example, if I put a green tile floor together and all the tiles on the floor are green, then what do I get? I get a green floor. And the reason I get a green floor is because greenness is intrinsic to the things that are all put together. And likewise, if I put whatever geometric figures together, what I get is what is intrinsic with regards to the geometric figures, that they are geometric figures. I get them if I put them together. I may not get a triangle, which is not necessarily intrinsic since there are multiple kinds of geometric figures. I may not get a triangle that exists, but I do get what is intrinsic to the geometric figures, that is, that their nature is to produce geometric figures. And that's what I get. I think that if we look at the notion of contingent beings or effects, to put it this way, that the nature of effects is that they're dependent beings, is that if you add them up, put them together, or group them together, they're only going to amount to an effect. We can add up all the effects in the universe, and all they will give us is an effect. They won't give us a necessary cause for their existence in any way. I think that what we have to do is look at the nature of the effects, the nature of contingent beings. And so I don't think that my argument committed the fallacy of composition in any sense of the term. Third is some will say that it does not prove that God is infinite. I would reply that, in fact, it has to prove that he is infinite. If every finite thing needs a cause, then the cause of all finite things cannot be finite. Otherwise, it itself would need a cause. This, in fact, does prove that God is infinite because it shows that something necessary and eternal must exist. It can't be a finite God. It can't be something that is finite. Otherwise, it would just push the question back as to what is the cause of that which is finite. It would just put God into the series of effects or causations, and it wouldn't allow him to actually affirm in any sense that which is ultimate about the that which is ultimately needed to put forward for a cause of the contingency effects that exist. Some would say that it does not prove one God. Why can't it prove many gods? Well, again, you can't have two, or for that matter, more infinite beings. You can't have two ultimates or two supremes. It missed what I said at the end when I connected it with the God of Christianity in the Bible, all of which this God is proven by my argument. You can't have two or more gods with all the metaphysical attributes we discussed and identified with regards to God. You can't tell them apart because they would have to differ in some way. But the only way to differ is to show that one lacks what the other had. But the only things that we can show that they would lack are these metaphysical attributes. But if you take one of them away, then it's not that which is eternal and infinite anymore, and hence you can only have one eternal and infinite being. Some would say that this argument depends on the invalid ontological argument. This is what Immanuel Kant put forth as his major criticism of the traditional arguments for the existence of God. But what I would put forward is that at no point does my argument depend on the invalid ontological argument. It does not assume at any point necessary existence as a demonstration of the argument itself. After I demonstrate that that which exists is eternal and necessary at premise three, what I do is I then from that point on take forward the notion of an ontological definition. I start to use ontology in terms of looking towards myself and what is true about myself, and extrapolate that back to God as being the cause of those certain things. There I'm using an ontological definition about myself and concluding that since God does exist as being eternal and necessary, demonstrated through premises 1 through 3, that therefore what I extrapolate back about myself in an ontological sense must be eternal and necessary about God in an ontological definitional sense. But nowhere is the argument actually dependent on a demonstration of the existence of God in terms of ontology. It is completely dependent upon the cosmological argument itself for its demonstration, which again is validly done by basing it or grounding it in the first principle that is existentially undeniable. Some would say that this does not prove a first cause. There could be an infinite series of causes without a first one. Well, again, an infinite regress, as we argued for throughout the argument, and we'll clarify here, is not possible. An infinite series is not possible for at least three reasons. Let me give you two reasons in this slide, and then one more reason in the next slide. First of all, there cannot be an infinite, there cannot be an actual infinite series. There can only be abstract, cognitive, or mathematical infinites. This will make extensive use for in our horizontal argument, and I think we can take from that argument this notion here. Actual infinites don't exist because various absurdities result from them. Once I take the notion of an infinite and actually start to apply it to real material things that exist in the universe, I get a number of very absurd things. For example, just briefly, and we'll make much more extensive use of this, if I conceive of an actual infinite number of books, say in a library, it becomes an absurdity because I could never take a book out of the library and reduce it in any sense in terms of it being reduced in terms of its numbers. But conceivably, I can take 100 books out of the library if there's an infinite number of real books that exist, and yet its number wouldn't be reduced because it's an infinite if I take them out. So we get all these kinds of absurdities existing in terms of an actual infinite when it's applied to real things. Second, the principle of causality does not claim that everything is being caused, but only that finite things. This confuses the principle of causality that I have used with the principle of sufficient reason, which I've avoided in my arguments. God is infinite and so does not need a cause. You can have a being that is uncaused. Not every being needs a cause, only finite changing beings need a cause. That being the case, this applies to the infinite regress because you would need to purport something that is uncaused outside the chain of causation in order to account for the chain that's existing. If you have a chain that exists, I'm talking in terms of a real chain with links in it, you can't just put forward another link in order to account for the existing chain. If you're going to hang the chain on the wall, you need to account for it hanging on the wall in terms of a peg that it hangs on the wall, not in terms of another link. Another link can't hang on the wall. You have to account for something that's a non-link in order to hang your chain on the wall. And again, my last reason that an infinite regress is not possible, because the infinite series of causes is conditioned, is a contradiction. Since every cause is causing, yet every cause is being caused. Hence, at least one cause is both causing being and being caused. If you don't purport or account for the chain of causation outside of itself, then it forces you to cause for it in terms of something that is in the chain that is both causing something else and causing itself. But again, causa sui is a contradiction because it would have to exist prior to its existence in order to cause itself to exist, and that just is impossible. So an infinite regress is not possible. Now, some object to the argument that I gave for the existence of God, that this is the same God of Islam. Now, you remember that we will argue evidentially later on, especially from history, that Christianity is true in an evidential sense and that Islam is false in an evidential sense. But nonetheless, I think it's worth put forwarding this notion here because some will say that this God that I've argued for does not distinguish it from the God of Islam. After all, as we'll note in the horizontal argument that we'll give next time, Islamic scholars put forth the notion of natural theology in their Kalam cosmological argument. They also argue in a similar fashion for the existence of God. So, what makes my God metaphysically different from their God? Even if evidentially I can prove Christianity is true, I think I can do that. As we'll see, that Jesus rose from the dead, and because Islam denies that, Islam is wrong and Christianity is true. But I think that there's also reasons that I can put forward here in a metaphysical sense that shows that the God of Islam is very different than the God that I've argued here, which is the Christian God. First of all, the God of Islam has the problem with absolute unity. And this notion of absolute unity, Islam says that God has no essence in any knowable sense. In fact, what is most fundamental about the understanding of the Islamic God is that he is absolute will in terms of being obeyed. But in God, in their understanding of God, there's no knowable essence. But you have to have an essence if you're going to put metaphysical attributes or attribute metaphysical attributes to God and say that you know those things, then you have to have an essence in which to attribute them. But if God is absolute unity, Islam is inconsistent in its understanding of God. Because even here, you can look into the Quran and what it says about God. It refers to the Quran itself being the eternal speech of God. Surah 85, 21 through 22, and Surah 13, 39, and Surah 43, 3 through 4 all speak of the eternal speech of God. So it wants to take the Quran and say that it is something attributable to God. But if there's no knowable essence in God, if there's no essence in God, then you can't attribute anything to God. God must have a nature if anything is to be ascribed to him, or he cannot be a necessary being. So again, with no knowable essence, you can't attribute anything to God. That's the problem again of absolute monotheism or absolute unity of God. The second problem is the problem of voluntarism. The problem of voluntarism in Surah 6:12 speaks of the notion of God being merciful or God not having to be merciful. Since God is absolute unity or absolute will, he could choose to act or choose not to act in a merciful way. Now, Islam would say we as human beings should act merciful, but God doesn't have to act merciful because he is the one that decided what is mercy and what isn't mercy. God decides what is good and isn't good because he's understood again in terms of absolute will. So ultimately, we can level the charge against the God of Islam that he's arbitrary. He does things not because they're right, rather they're right because he does them. But this is quite problematic to the understanding of God. And again, they have this problem because it's traceable back to the fact that God has no essence. The Christian understanding would attribute an essence to God and say that God's essence is that he is good, and God cannot act contrary to his essence or contrary to his nature. Therefore, that his nature or essence establishes what is good. So the God that I've argued for, because he has an essence or a nature, is not subject to this criticism or this problem of voluntarism. And then the final thing, or let me restate it here, things are right because God does them, is the understanding or the problem of voluntarism. And again, Christianity is not subject to that because they attach goodness to his essence or his nature, which God cannot deny. But again, the third problem is of the problem of agnosticism. The heart of Islam is not to know God. The heart of Islam is to obey him because he's absolute will without a knowable essence. This ultimately results in a God that is not knowable. This puts God above all and beyond all. And you say, well, where do they get this notion from in their understanding? Well, everything for them is an extrinsic causality for God. In their understanding of God, there's no intrinsic causality to God. Now, remember the difference between extrinsic and intrinsic causality that I earlier went over. For God, everything is caused extrinsically, and so many things are just arbitrarily decided upon him. There's nothing common in me that connects me with the God of Islam because there's nothing that is caused in me that is an intrinsic causation. For them, the notion of personality, morality, and intellect are all extrinsic causations for God, of God that completely removes him from me being known, or from me, removes God from me and any sense of me having an intimate knowledge of God in terms of a knowable essence. It just isn't there. But if this is so, then God should be the cause of things that are evil. God should be the cause of faithless, of those who are faithless, since he's ultimately the cause of all things. But of course, this puts me in the position that is this really a God I want to know? Is this a God worth knowing? If there is something that the Islamic scholar would say is attributable to God, that is in God himself, then he has to put forward the notion that he must have an essence in order to attribute it to him. In this sense of making God, or in this sense of the problem of agnosticism, of making God that is above and beyond all, they really take this from the notion of Neoplatonism, particularly Plotinus. The medieval Islamic scholars really followed Plotinus. Now, if you remember in our worldview discussion, Plotinus produced a version of pantheism. And I'm not saying that the Islamic understanding of God is panentheistic, but this particular notion of them taking this idea that God is above and beyond all is from Plotinus. And this puts forward a notion that God is only known through mysticism, and this is why Sufism is very prominent in Islam. This notion of a mystical experience is the only way to know God because you have to get beyond even all categories of thought in order to come into union or at least approach this unknowable God. If that's the case, there's no similarity between what is beyond God and what God is. So God ultimately is unknowable in the Islamic sense. So I think these problems put forward in a metaphysical sense create a metaphysical distinction between the God that I've argued for, because one, he has a knowable essence. Number two, his essence is goodness in an infinite and eternal sense, and since he cannot operate apart from or contrary to his very essence or nature, that is what good is, and therefore God can't do things that aren't good or can't do things that are evil. And third, we can know God because he does cause these things intrinsically. We're personally the causation of personal things in us that are intrinsically, such as our personality, morality, and intelligence. Therefore, we can have a notion of a relationship with God who is eternal. But these things are completely absent from an Islamic understanding of God, and I think clearly separates in a metaphysical sense. The God that I've argued for here is the Christian God of theism from the God of Islam. And the last one I'll put forward, which seemed to be fairly straightforward and obvious, but at least I'll put it forward here in our last objection we'll look at. Could Judaism argue that their God of the Old Testament is metaphysically not the same God of the New Testament? But I would put forward the notion that that's just not possible. First of all, both clearly claim monotheism. The Lord our God is one, is claimed in Mark 12:22, a New Testament book. Both claim the exact same thing about God, that he is monotheism. And not only that, both claim all the same attributes. We claimed that from our argument and from the scriptures that God is all powerful, he's all knowing and intelligent, he is all good, he's eternal and necessary. He's unchanging, he's infinite and omnipresent. There's not a distinction between the claims of these attributes in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. That being the case, they must be the same God. They're not metaphysically distinct or different. So, in review of our outline for apologetics, in our apologetic argument, you'll see that at this point we've established the God of the theistic worldview exists. And we've mainly established this using the vertical cosmological argument. The vertical cosmological argument for the theistic God of Christianity is demonstrative or demonstrable. And by that I mean it's sound, it's valid, and hence it actually establishes the existence of God. Now, in our second half or second part of this, we'll argue for this premise in our overall argument or outline of apologetics from the horizontal cosmological argument and prove that the theistic God of Christianity is demonstrable as well. In that sense, we'll have two arguments that we can draw from as Christian apologists to actually demonstrate the existence of God and establish the second point in our outline that the God of the theistic worldview exists.